Have you ever considered that the Christmas story started in Rome? Caesar Augustus issued a decree that all the world should be enrolled in a census. Just consider, in the ancient world, how long it would have taken for such news to travel. By the time citizens and soldiers arrive at a remote little village called Bethlehem, 2,500 miles from Rome, it would have been a year and most likely more that would have passed. That means before the angel ever appeared to Mary in Nazareth or an old priest named Zechariah in the temple in Jerusalem, the activity that launched the sequence of events that became the Christmas story began in Rome. It's an interesting thought when you consider what Rome is. That Rome, not the visit of an angel, not a heavenly party that began some series of events, but Rome, the Caesar, political power, process, a decree, that started the Christmas story. That's an interesting thought. Rome, of course, was the largest empire to date at that point in history. Rome did many good things. It created a highway system that connected the world like never before. It brought aqueducts with fresh drinking water that made large urban civilizations possible. But there were other things Rome brought. A justice system that favored itself. A lack of cultural sensitivity to many of the countries they invaded. Like any government, there was good and there was not so good. Rome represented those places of power where decisions can be made that affect your life and you have no power over it. What does Rome look like today? Some would say it looks like Washington, D.C., where laws get made that affect our taxes, laws regarding immigration, the rights of people, on and on you could go. Some would say it looks a little closer to home. It looks like the State House in Indianapolis, where laws are passed that affect housing rights and gun laws and business practices. You could say that Rome looks like the corporate headquarters of the company we work for. Well, Atlanta said we've got to cut our workforce by 50%. Ooh. Sometimes Rome looks like the doctor's office. Well, we're sorry, Mr. Fuquay. We can no longer carry you and provide care for you. What do you mean? No, we're sorry. You see, we don't carry your insurance company anymore. I have had you as my doctor the whole time I've been in Indiana. Well, we'd like to keep providing care for you. If you can talk your insurance company into changing their practices, see you later. Rome looks like all of those places that have power that affect our lives that we feel powerless to control. Why does the Christmas story start there? Because between us and something we long for, something we want, something we need, is usually a Rome. Something of power that stands in the way. And so the Christmas story starts in Rome because it invites us to think about what is it I really long for in my life. This year, this Advent, where my life is right now, what am I longing for? What am I seeking? What do I want? And what do my longings have to do with the longings of God? That's a good question. That should keep you busy all week. What do my longings have to do with the longings of God? But Rome is more than some far away empire and entity. You know what? Rome is us as well, especially this church. We have significant people in St. Luke's who wield influence and authority and every day go to work and make decisions that affect the lives of hundreds and thousands, and for a few of you, even millions. We represent Rome. And if you're going, well, there may be people like that in St. Luke's, but it's not me, then just be aware. We all have a Rome of some kind. We all have people who are affected by our decisions and what we do in life. And so another good question that connects with Rome for us here at the start of Advent is to ask ourselves, what's my Rome? Who are the people impacted by the things I do in my life? And how would God have me use my Rome? Now, to help us think about these questions today, we have a special guest with us. Somebody who has represented the peak of government authority in the state of Indiana for the past 8 years. His term runs out in 6 weeks, and he has been super gracious to come today and for part of our message, allow me to interview him. Would you please welcome the governor of Indiana, Eric Holcomb.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Well, along with welcoming Governor Holcomb, I want to welcome his wife, Janet, who is with us also. And Governor, I want to recognize that you have a number of interesting connections with St. Luke's. First of all, your parents are members of the church, Neil and Marcia Holcomb. Would you guys stand for just a moment? Let us recognize you. Ah. You didn't think Mom and Dad were going to stay home on you today, did you? If ever. Also, you played basketball for Ed Siegel, didn't you?
Ed Siegel said I couldn't jump over a dime. You all know Ed Siegel, so you can hear him saying it.
Ed Siegel passed away from the coronavirus back in 2020. Was the coach at Pike,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Where you were
legendary.
One of his players and students mm-hmm. there. Also, I just found this out from Mary Ann McGriff that this summer mm-hmm. in Normandy at the 80th ceremonies, you made a special effort to get to Utah Beach to greet Carver McGriff. I believe we have a picture of that.
Oh.
You were there when Carver spoke. Oh. At those ceremonies, and I did not realize you were there until she shared that picture with me. And then one more. See if this takes you down memory lane from something you and I did a few years ago. Let's run that.
He sees you when you're sleeping.
He knows when you're awake.
He knows when you've been bad or good.
So you better be good for goodness sake.
You better be good for good.
Oh, nice job.
Sake.
Nice job.
That was early.
I didn't warn you about that. No, I just thought you would enjoy that little trip
mercy.
Down memory lane. All right.
Yeah.
You're in a position, you make decisions every day that win you a lot of support, and maybe it's too strong to say, but probably creates a lot of enemies as well. Let me start with an easy one. Who do you favor more, IU or Purdue?
I root for one and pray for the other.
Oh. Do you ever think of politics as a possible career for yourself? All right. You're just about to complete 8 years as governor. What have you loved about being governor of Indiana?
Oh, it's a long list, but I think at the core of it all, from really day one, was the ability, if you're motivated by this, but and I am, is the ability to be a force for good on a scale comparable to other examples or vocations in life, but certainly when you have about almost 30,000 people mm-hmm. out trying to do good, out trying to strengthen individuals, help families, that's the way you make stronger communities. And so to be a part of that every day, reaching into all 92 counties, and then to see good come from it, it's salary enough.
What's been the hardest thing about being governor?
Most would, if you could answer that for me, most people tell me living through a global pandemic or trying to do the best we could with the information that we had, real time, steering, balancing lives and livelihoods, infringing on people's ways of life. I took that very seriously. And it was, there were some days where you thought, when will this end? But that's really not, there's silver linings in everything, I believe. And we became, as a state administration, even closer. We were always a tight cabinet, but we became almost family. And I think that's when a lot of Hoosiers almost, I likened it to going to Oz and pulling the curtain back, and Hoosiers that I meet in line at MCL will tell me, ask me about Dr. Box, or ask me about Fred Payne, or ask me about the Adjutant General of our Indiana National Guard, Dale Lyles, because they saw them on a very regular basis. But that, you know, there was good that came out of a very difficult situation. I think the hardest for me personally, and I'm not crying about this, but the hardest, certainly speaking at funerals was something that I didn't anticipate it happening as often as it has. And when you talk about losing Libby and Abby up in Delphi, or you talk about someone who's in the military coming home in a way otherwise imagined, or some law enforcement official taken from us prematurely in the line of duty, understanding the pain, even, you know, that the families are going through, right, knowing that they're in heaven, but still the loss. Those are very difficult personal situations. And then on a very practical level, just not taking the bait. The introduction, I was fearful that you were going to say, you know, there are good politicians and bad politicians. Welcome, Governor Holcomb. And just understanding this world in which we do live in, there are folks who are motivated by things other than, I think, being productive. And so whether it's someone of a different partisan stripe or a gotcha reporter that could be in Sydney, or Rome, or Indiana, Rome, Italy, you have to, one, have the skin of a rhinoceros, and two, you have to make sure you understand what is motivating the incoming, because you are, just by virtue of holding an elective office, you're a target-rich environment.
I want to dig into that a little bit, but I want to say, I know you get pulled into lots of controversial decisions, and maybe you even initiate decisions that can be very controversial, but I believe your leadership during COVID was a voice of reason. You were level-headed, and I feel you acted in the best interest of the health of all Hoosiers, and I want to say thank you for that. You provided wonderful leadership to us.
I appreciate that, but credit where credit's due, and it goes back to the team, like,
sure,
in life, to the membership, to those who are, you're surrounded by, and we just had such a talented crew focused on, you know, the carrying out the smartly, hopefully, the plan of the day.
So let me ask you this. Some people might think, they might say, a perception of your office makes you in a position of power that when it comes to some big issue in Indiana, you can do whatever you want. If you speak and if you decide, you can change whatever needs to be changed. You have that kind of power. In what ways is that accurate, and in what ways is it inaccurate?
It's inaccurate, and I get this all the time, and you're exactly right. You know, I remember very early on going to a basketball game, and someone sitting right next to me who I had never met before, almost a quarter into the game, you know, I said hello and introduced myself, and then it was silence, until about a quarter in, and he finally leaned over. This is, again, a number of years ago, so it's not current. They said, you know, you need to fire the coach of Indiana University's basketball team. And I said, well, you know, that's kind of the president. Well, you hire the trustees. Well, I mean, I appoint trustees, and they run the... And so there are a lot of, and there are, by the way, there are, I understand that sometimes the cynicism that's out there, because there are good and bad, like in every vocation, politicians who weigh into issues of which they have exactly zero authority.
Right.
And it's more rhetorical. It's not so much about ultimate results or the pursuit of perfection other than progress. And so I try now, I'm very aware of that, and try to stay focused again on my lane and staying in my lane, understanding there's a local government, there's a federal government, there's the state government, there's different branches, and so a healthy respect and actually showing that, being disciplined to prove that through my walk, I think is something that I can contribute beyond the authority of the office that, you know, I am bound by a constitution.
You're a person of faith, right?
Yes, sir.
How does your faith influence the way you go about your work, especially these last 8 years?
Daily, obviously, I try to start and end my day in communication with higher authority, the highest. And then try not to forget it throughout the day. If people often do, and I appreciate it, I feel the power of prayer, and they will often say, "What can I pray? You know, pray for you." And I always say, "For me to carry out His will, not my own." And through those different temptations throughout the day, and not to lose sight of that. I also have a healthy dose of fear of the Lord, and which is obviously compelling to force you to run to Him, not away from Him, throughout the day. And so making sure I'm keeping in context the bigger picture is very influential, no matter how small or big the issue of the day is, in the valleys and at the peaks, by the way.
Mm-hmm. I want to tell a quick story to set up my next question. When I was in seminary, I took a class on the Sermon on the Mount, some of the really hard teachings of Jesus. And one day I came to classroom, and I knew something was up because there were these guys standing around the door with earplugs. I mean, they're like listening devices in their ears. And I thought, what is going on? Well, a few minutes later, Jimmy Carter came in. He had just left office about a year and a half before, and he was our guest lecturer that day. And he talked about how he spent his whole life seeking to live by the values of the Sermon on the Mount, but he realized as President of the United States, he could not be fully Christian. Hmm. And we all kind of did that. We went, what? Mm-hmm. And he said, for instance, he doesn't believe in killing, but everywhere he goes, somebody trails behind him with a suitcase that has a button in it.
Yeah.
And as President of the United States, he must accept a vow that if his office required it, he would push that button that could mean the deaths of thousands or even millions of people. So my question, have you ever found yourself in a situation where it's hard to live by your faith and carry out the offices of your responsibilities?
It's certainly a challenge you to think through the issue of the day. And these are issues that what was written in Romans is true today as it was then. And so we're still grappling with or struggling with similar challenges. So I'm aware of that, but I'm also aware that the number one, in an executive position, oftentimes you are left to make a decision that no one else can. By design. And I think if you're a good leader, you're empowering those around you to make all the decisions so that you're hopefully left with only those that only you can make. And that's how you surround yourself and foster and cultivate a good team. But also, just in a larger context, we're human, and the Lord works through us. And so when we are grappling with these issues of the day, we have to be informed, know the Word, understand that there are disagreements within the church, within government, within parties, within families, on different interpretations, and then try to be true to yourself after a lot of thought and study, speaking to others in authority. The number of pastors around the state that I'm in communication with is very helpful to me. I try to approach that and not lose who I am and what I stand for, even though I may disagree at the end of the day with someone in the congregation.
You've made decisions related to topics like abortion that can have implications of women's health care, guns, transgender rights, capital punishment. Some would say that elements of the decisions would not be in alignment with United Methodist doctrine. How do you carry that? How do you manage that when,
as a Methodist?
In any faith tradition where the things that you're doing, you go, okay, there may be these statements approved by a denomination. I'm going against that. I'm making this kind of decision. For you, how do you balance that tension?
Humbly, I hope, and with a sense of awareness, understanding that again, and I do, and it's real, I have a healthy dose of fear in the Lord, and so I understand that He is working, I hope, through me and others, everyone, through various tough times, and to understand that at the end of the day, you have to make, as I said, you have to make the best informed decision, understanding that we're all part of this. And ultimately, these decisions come down to people who are active, who are involved. And while I'm one person that holds elective office today, it's temporary. It's, you know, I have 43 days left, 1,032 hours if you're keeping score at home. But issues will come and go, and we have to make informed decisions, and that the good Lord works through us and through everything, always, every day. And I understand I'm part of all of that.
Do you feel that I feel like I know the answer you might give to this, but that we've lost the ability to disagree on topics without going to the extreme of the reason you decide this is, and then go in sort of like to the darkest place and lose the humanity of the people we're talking to? How have you experienced that as governor?
Well, I absolutely agree with that. And one big reason why I hope that our administration, not just me, reflects that there is a better way, that and with that comes some pressure to act accordingly, meaning to be an example of not being abrasive, not being caustic, not being toxic, not being trying to tear down, but trying to build up, having the skin of a rhinoceros, as I said, to carry on with a plan and to be focused on that plan, not be diverted, not take the bait. And I think if there are more examples out there, of which we all can be, there is an alternative. And that's part of what I underestimated coming into office. If you just look at the last 8 years, 10 years, 20 years, one thing that distinguishes this time is social media being almost a fuel to excite and spread misinformation or disinformation or hate. And so therefore it calls for an equal or greater force alternative to be the light. And that's where we all come in. And that's something I'll take very seriously forever, not just time in office.
I want to bring this to a close and let you have a free shot at us. You of course know about St. Luke's, and I know you can appreciate
a special place. We were married here.
Yep. You have an awareness of the resources of this congregation. I'm not just talking about money, but influence.
Sure.
What would you say to St. Luke's about our Romes, about the influence we have, and what you feel like we can do to help make our world better? What would you say to us?
Well, I would, I don't want to come off as preaching to the baritone section of the choir, but I would tell you what you already know and alluded to, and first take stock of or recognize, indeed, you are blessed with, you said treasure, but also talent, and maybe even more precious than that, time. I know everyone is busy, but time to connect with others and to not underestimate your ability. Whether or not you have money, I guarantee you, you have credibility with different walks in life. And if you walk into a prison and or volunteer at the United Way or 4-H or fill in the blank, you can connect with someone that can change their life. And it ultimately does, at the end of the day, comes down to our relationship with the Lord, but with each other, to make change. And so being part of this church, God ordained three institutions, by the way, as you know. And so what are we to do, not just inside the family or church or inside government, like unlike Rome, who made those laws favor the few or maintain their leadership, but what are we doing outside of the, in my case, limestone walls? And what are we contributing? And I would just say that you can trace it back when you hear of a personal testimony that was changed. It comes from our walks, our individual walks. And that is powerful. And that is the way I was asked at the Truman Center not long ago in a kind of a rapid fire line of questioning, what was one of my greatest concerns? And I said the lack of community or the eroding community. And you can, all different types of reasons, demographic shifts, it was already alluded to earlier today, this morning, move into the urban areas, Rome, making that ability, but also the inward looking posture of people. Self-selecting what community, clicking to be a friend. Like, we have to quit clicking to be friends. We have to actually go across the street two houses down and meet in person, go where they are who are in need. And that's the power of the nourishment that you get here maybe at 9:30. What are you doing with it? And I would just suggest this is a powerful place that can make enormous change, much more so than in the State House.
Well, I know there are people in St. Luke's, when it comes to individual issues, get very passionate and have a lot of strong feelings on things that would be different from what our governor decides. But our governor's a good man. And I won't have this chance again before you step out of office to just say, thank you for your leadership. Thanks for being with us today. Would you express your thanks to Governor Eric Holcomb?
Thank you, sir.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
God bless you. Thank you.
And next time, I'll be right.
I know this would be a perfect time to go right into the closing hymn, but I can't resist a chance to share a couple more things. I want to pick up on something the governor said about trusting God working through us, because when it comes to our rooms, I believe that's a couple of takeaways for us. One of them is to trust in the work of God in the midst of the things we long for. Last month, Susan and I went to New York, and I wanted to go to Redeemer Presbyterian Church in Midtown Manhattan. That was the church started by Tim Keller back in the 1970s. He wanted to begin a church for smart-thinking people who've given up on the faith. Sitting next to me that morning was a young woman from Columbia University, a room full of people in their 20s and 30s, smart, brilliant people. Tim Keller died last year. His son is the pastor now. When I think about the history of how that church came to be and the 175 like them in other parts of the world, it's an interesting one, because Tim Keller was influenced by a man named Andrew Lincoln, a professor from Great Britain who taught at Gordon Conwell Seminary in New York City. And the reason that person got to be there, as I tell the story in my book, was a sequence of events in which Gerald Ford's son was a student there and was able to convince his dad to apply a little pressure on the State Department to get Andrew Lincoln here. And that was all because of the Watergate scandal. One of the darkest moments in American history. A time when a lot of people said, did God go to sleep on America? What is wrong with our country? But if you looked for it, you saw that God was doing something at that time that is continuing to make a difference in the world. So trust and then seek. Look for the ways God is moving beyond the news channels, beyond the headlines, in the everyday affairs of people, because God is at work, God is moving, and God is active, and God will not quit on accomplishing God's will for our world. Let us pray. Gracious God, we thank you for this pause to think about Rome long ago and today, to think about our own longings and what we hope for, to say thank you for our governor and his work in this state, his trust in you to work through decisions made, and to know that your work is always bigger and more powerful than all the decisions we make, and yet they're important, and you use them. So continue to bless us and all of our positions of authority, whatever that looks like, to be people of faith who trust in you and who look and seek your presence and hand at work in our world for all that is not lined up according to your will, for all that doesn't look like the kingdom we believe in. Give us faith and give us activity to practice that faith. In Christ's holy name, amen. Let's stand and sing one verse.